Well, thank you for allowing me to come. It is a great privilege. I love this book, and I sense I'm in a church that loves this book as well. Just quickly, so you know who's talking to you, I've been a youth pastor for 15 years, and just over a year ago, year and a half or so ago, I've started with a ministry called the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry. And that ministry, first of all, is reaching out to Jewish people. And not only, a lot of people ask me, are there Jewish people in Perth? Well, yes, there's 8,000 to 10,000 Jewish people in Perth. Not only that, most of them are in, do you know what suburbs? Dianella, Yokine, Menorah, which is a Jewish word, so that's a bit of a giveaway. But also, there's a little hub actually, surprisingly, here. One of my good friends, I'm in a Jewish music group, and he is just around the corner there in Kingsley. And I'm learning Hebrew, and my Hebrew teacher, he lives just here in Woodvale. Very interesting that I thought I'd be going all the time down there, but just around in my circles, I'm meeting with people who are Jewish. And so it's good for me to represent you. I don't know if you realize that, but when you say you're from the church and you stand with Israel, their response is usually, we thought the churches hate us. That is their general understanding of church, because when you say church, they think Catholic, and their history with the church universal is horrific. And if you knew even half of what we have done or what has been done in our name, you would understand how shameful it is to say, I'm Christian. So you need to explain to them that there are some Christians actually who take the Bible as it's written and take a place for the Jewish people, and therefore appreciate them as the ones who've brought us the scriptures, as the ones who've brought us our Messiah, and those kind of things. But not only do I reach out to the Jewish people, but I also reach out to the churches, because this book is a Jewish book. And when we return to its Jewish roots, it makes sense. It connects. When we move away from it, we lose a lot of the context and the grounding of where it is. Just last night, I was reading an article from the Jerusalem Post because the Pope, who represents the Catholic Church, Catholic meaning universal, and he celebrated Mass in Bethlehem, Beit Lechem, where Jesus was born. And the commentator, a Jewish commentator, was making the point there was nothing there that connected Jesus to Jewishness. He was wearing a Palestinian kafir on his head as a little Jewish boy. And all this ritual, and he said, I couldn't see anything Jewish there. So therefore, there's no surprise that the Jewish people see no connection between the church and the faith that they brought to us. And so one of my missions is to help the church come back to realize their roots are in Judaism. They are not into Judaism, but their roots are Hebrew. And at the same time, helping the Jewish people realize that actually, if we take the scriptures literally, the Messiah they look for has been found, and they can find him too. The beautiful other thing about, I guess, as we start into the psalm is, you're not here to hear from me. One of the great privileges of church is we get to hear from people who've met with God, who God said, write this so people throughout the generations can hear it. So it is our privilege today to hear from Moses, or in the Jewish culture, Moshe. We're hearing from a man of God, a Jewish man of God, who God chose to birth the Jewish nation, who God chose to write the first five books of our scriptures. He is the one who teaches us this morning. Now, that is an incredible privilege. We don't just come to hear a nice idea from this guy called Kevin who is in a ministry. No, I've been asked to come and prepare over hours and hours and hours to understand what this is saying so that we can rejoice together with the one God chose to give us the Word of God. Church is a wonderful privilege. And as we start, it's an interesting start. He who dwells in the... wrong psalm. Now, we might tend to start this psalm, Lord, you have been our dwelling place, but that's not actually where it starts, is it? In the Hebrew scriptures, the prayer of Moses, the man of God, is actually part of the psalm. So sometimes the verses are out of whack in the Hebrew to the English because that is part of the psalm. And it actually tells us a lot, if you think about it, about where we're going here this morning. This is not just a psalm, it's a prayer. So we're going to learn about prayer. We're going to learn about a prayer from a man of God who saw God in a burning bush. That's pretty special. Now, the other interesting thing here, and this we might not realise, but is actually a clue to the whole psalm, is man of God. You see, that is a strange contradiction when you read the psalm. Man who is mortal and corrupt and finite and is headed towards destruction. God who is immeasurable and incorruptible and will never even fade, let alone die. Man of God. How do you put those two things together? That is the introduction to the psalm. Think about it. It's a bit like saying poverty of riches or frailty of immortality, the rage of perfect peace. When you hear those things, you're saying, Kevin, that is bizarre. What are you talking about? But that's what you're supposed to think when you hear man of God. They do not fit together. How do they go together? How does the incorruptible go with what is corrupt? How does what is imperishable go with perishable? And then he says the first words proper of his psalm, not his prayer. His prayer is in verse 12, his psalm. Lord, you, the eternal God, have been our dwelling place in all generations. What a beautiful introduction. That's enough for me. Just to meditate on those words is fantastic. Lord, and the word there is Adonai, the one who is the Lord of all, is our dwelling place. So our dwelling place is not a place, it's a person. Interesting, isn't it? We as human beings look for a home, a place to dwell. But the reality is our home is with the eternal, with our God. He is our dwelling place. And that word dwelling place there has a depth of meaning. It's used of God's dwelling place, heaven. It's used of the temple through the Old Testament scriptures. It's used of the tabernacle, which Moses and the people of Israel went through to the promised land. It's also used of a intimate sexual relationship between man and wife. So it's that cohabitation on the most intimate level. It's also used of an animal with its lair. So it's got a broad meaning, but the heart of it is deep, rich intimacy. Think who's saying this at the start of the psalm. It's Moses. Moses, the man who never had a physical home. He was kicked out of Egypt for murder. He was not welcome in Egypt. He never entered the promised land. God would not permit him to because he showed anger when he should have showed respect to God. So here the man without a home says, Lord, you have been our dwelling place through all generations. And here we introduce this contradiction of man and God. All the generations, he's thinking of all the generations of Israelites, presumably, all bound up in this one home, God. It doesn't matter if their life was cut off at the very start, as many of them were in Egypt. They were thrown out into the desert to die. Their home was in God. They just got to their home a lot quicker. It doesn't matter if they had a long life and missed out on the promised land by that much. Their home, their dwelling place is in God. Even if they got to enjoy the whole promised land for a good 40, 50, 60 years, that's not their home. Their home is in God. And so he enters us into this wonderful reminder, where is our home? When I say, where is your home? Where does your heart go? And the challenge to say, lift your thoughts. Are you at home here? Can you say, I'm in my dwelling place? Because God is here. We're looking at his revelation. What more do I need? Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. And then he continues this thought that man is mortal, that there's all these generations that die off that because they are mortal with God, the immortal. So he says, before the mountains, literally it says, were born or brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. He picks on the mountains because we often look at mountains as something, they've been there forever, haven't they? I mean, they are just permanently fixed. It's just immovable. They must have been there forever. Moses reminds us, don't forget Genesis 1. They had a birth, a time. They actually have a life cycle like everything else of creation. So even the things that we think are the most permanent, to God, they're just temporary. There was just a moment in time where he said, let there be, and there were mountains. And that started their life cycle. Yet God has no life. He is everlasting in both directions. He's not only everlasting going forward into eternity, he's everlasting going backward into eternity. And you've got this incredible contrast between everlasting to everlasting, and even mountain is this big compared to his eternity. And then we have the contrast with man in verses 3 and following. Man is born to destruction, not originally born to destruction, but because of sin is now born to destruction. Verse 3, you turn man to destruction and say, return, O children of men. We are the opposite to everlasting. We aren't even living. Biologists will tell us we're actually dying. So as soon as we are born, we are not living, we are actually in the process of dying. What a contrast between the everlasting God. And so he actually makes a reference to Genesis 3. Notice in verse 2, he references Genesis 1. Now he references Genesis 3. Verse 19 of Genesis 3 says, in the sweat of your brow you will eat bread, and you return to the ground. For out of it you were taken, and dust you are, and to dust you shall return. So here he says he's reminding man of where they're returning to, because they are corrupt. Return to the ground, O children of men. That is your destiny. And he's reminding them the whole context of that story where God said, follow my way and live. And Adam and Eve in the garden said, what about my way, as we heard off in communion this morning? What about my way? What about that delicious tree and the fruit on it? I'd just like to try my way and see where it takes me. And God says, do you know where it's taken you? To destruction. You are now headed on a course where you are no longer living, you are dying. To destruction you are destined, O man, and return to death, O children of men. Because we rejected God's eternal wisdom, we make this path our own, and God turns us there. Now, there may, and this is where there's some debate over this, there may be a hint here where God is actually calling them to return to what they were. In other words, yes, you've been turned to destruction, but why not return back to me, the one who is everlasting? So there's some debate about that, even amongst Jewish scholars, of what that could mean. But it's nice to think about that, isn't it? Is he purely highlighting our mortality and saying you will return to death? Or is he actually also saying, don't forget there's a potential, because I am the God who redeems, to return to life again? Worth meditating on. By the way, all verses 1 to 11 are the meditation in preparation for the prayer. So Moses, knowing the greatness of God, doesn't just turn up for prayer. He actually reflects on who God is, who he is, before he enters his prayer in verse 12. Maybe a good challenge for us in our prayer life as well. Now, what's this verse 4? For 1,000 years are in your sight like yesterday when it is past, and like a watch in the night. Anyone know who lived the longest of all men? Methuselah. How long did he last? 969 years. Summary, 1,000 years. Do you see what he's doing here? He's quoted Genesis 1, he's quoted Genesis 3. Now he's looking at Genesis 5, where it lists all the generations of man. And you've got Jared, 962. You've got Lamech, and you've got Mahalalel, 895. And you've got Methuselah, 969. The best man can do is 1,000 years. What are they to God? Yesterday. They're like a sleep to God, where he wakes up and goes, ah, 1,000 years gone? Oh, wow, Methuselah's dead. It's like a watch in the night, which is 3 hours. And he says, that's what man's life is to me. Now, he's not saying it's not important, but he's saying, man, get your perspective. Why are you living for now? Why are you focused on the temporal when you should be looking at me. Remember, I'm your dwelling place. I am eternal. How long is your life compared to eternity with me? Why are you going to destruction still? And so Moses reflects and says, I admit, Lord, I agree with you. Methuselah, in my sight, is pretty impressive. And now that we only live 70 years or so, I'm pretty jealous. But I'm looking in the wrong place. Why am I looking at everlasting to everlasting instead of going, gee, I wish I was Methuselah? And he's getting his perspective right before he enters prayer with God. So he takes that image to a common image in the Bible, which is we are like grass. We sprout up, and what do? When we see green grass? Wow, that is beautiful. This is awesome. This is great. Look how green my grass is. Forgot to water. It's brown. That's how temporary grass is. That's how temporary our life is. When we're young, what do we think? I can do anything. I can go speeding down the freeway 200 kilometres an hour. I'm not going to die. And you play basketball and you can play all day. You can hike mountains. Then you get to about 40 and you go, hey, what's that bald spot to play? What? Grey starts turning up. And you go play a game of basketball and you're exhausted halfway through the match. You go, what's going on? I'm like grass. I think I'm still invincible, but I'm like grass. I can get blown down like that. I get sick and I think I'm dying. I am so much like grass. In fact, he's also saying the generations are like grass. And you think of where he's going. He's thinking through Genesis. Abraham, a great nation is going to come from you. This is going to be fantastic. This generation, it's going to happen. Well, he gets one son of promise, Isaac. Oh, okay, well, maybe the next generation. We now have Isaac. The great generation will come. Well, you get Jacob. Maybe this generation. Well, he has 12 sons. We're getting some. We've gone from one promised son to 12. Maybe now. 400 years of slaves in Egypt. They're dying out. The Pharaoh has made an edict that every male child will be murdered, will be slaughtered, so that Israel will be wiped out. Lord, where are your promises? We're like grass. Every generation, we hope it's going to sprout up, and nothing happens. From here, he looks at the one who wipes out grass. Verse 7, it says, for we are being consumed by your anger and by your wrath we are terrified. It picks up the image of breath. You know how, particularly in Israel, where they don't have grass like we do, think of grass out on a field, and a hot breeze comes along and it just wipes out the grass. It can be green because of a bit of a rain, but a lot of it is desert and the water just falls through. Hot wind comes through and it's just wiped out. Now, the word used for God's anger and God's wrath is actually literally hot breath. It's like the fury of God coming through and like a dragon and just wiping out. And he's making the point that when God sees our sins, our iniquities, it makes him so angry. And we are wiped out. That is our destiny. And you think, well, that's a bit rough. In our day and age, we're not comfortable with God's anger. We don't talk much about God's anger. But the Bible does. Psalm 7:11 said God is angry at the wicked every day. Romans in our New Testament 1:18 says God's wrath is, present tense, being poured out on wickedness. The only thing that holds back this breath of God coming upon us is his mercy. And there is a time coming, as you read about in your scriptures, when that mercy will be at an end. And he said it is time for justice on the earth. Note how these verses turn from general principles about God and man to specifics. In the first six verses, it's about God and man. You'll see those pronouns in there. Now it talks about you and we, you and ours, you and us. And it's like the lion, this immense creature that is God, they're looking at it from a distance, and now it turns and faces him. And he has to face his own sin and iniquity and the potential of the hot breath of God. And therefore he says, Lord, we've been consumed. If you roar, I'm gone. And he focuses on why. He doesn't question it. He doesn't say, Lord, this is not fair. He understands this is justice. So he highlights the things that make this. Notice it says the word iniquities, verse 8. Iniquity is not just sin. Sin is the acts or that we miss the mark of God. Iniquity is that our heart is crooked, that it's bent, that we cannot choose right. That's iniquity. It's Romans 7 where Paul says, why don't I do what I want to do? Why do I do the things I don't want to do, and the things I don't want to do is the things I do? The answer is iniquity. His heart's crooked, and therefore it is bent towards what is wrong. It is bent towards destruction. That's what he's saying here. Verse 8b, then he mentions the other word, sin, which is we cannot hit the mark. We miss the mark time and time again of what God wants of us. And notice there, we're not even honest about it. Our secret sins, that's our problem. When we do something wrong, what is our natural instinct? I hope no one saw that. I hope no one knew that was a lie. And we hide it. We're our own worst enemy. We know sin is contagious, and we know because we can spot in other people, that person lied to me. That person did something that is wrong. And yet with ourselves we go, oh, I hope no one noticed. I hope no one picked that up. And what does it do? It makes it worse. It makes it seat in our soul and infects. Sin is infectious to us. It's contagious to our world. And that's what makes God so furious. We deny it. We say, it's not a problem. And then we turn on the television and watch the news, don't we? Honour killing. There was an honour killing in Pakistan. Horrific. Did you know there's 1,000 honour killings in Pakistan every year? That's almost three a day. Now, we've just been highlighted because of a horrific case, but this is 1,000 murders by Sharia law, legal law in that country. That's why the police didn't do anything. That is happening every year. 5,000 in the world every year. And that's just one subject. Have you noticed paedophilia on the news in Australia today? Horrific. Even our heroes of Australia are the shame of Australia. And thousands of our young children are growing up with a crooked sense of sexuality. And we go, gotta get a sense of what sin does in our world. No wonder you hate it. Our world just heads towards horror. Judgment is the only solution. How do you fix something that contagious? And we could go on and list many, many other issues, as I'm sure come to your mind, that are shameful to us even in our society. It's no wonder that God is angry at our sin and our iniquity. And when we just took that first bite of the apple, he knew that a separation was going to be eternal. We go, what's the big deal? It's just biting an apple. And now thousands of years later, we watch the news and go, really? That's what's grown from eating this one piece of fruit? Verse 9, we serve our own interests. For all our days have passed away in your wrath. We just follow our own interests, not considering eternity. And we finish our years, my Bible says, finish our years like a sigh. And in the Hebrew, it's that idea, my life is over. What? Life's not eternal? Oh, no, I don't believe in God. I don't believe in eternity. My life's over. It just finishes with a sigh. We don't even consider the eternality and God, generally speaking, in our world. The days of our lives, verse 10, are 70 years, 80 if we have strength by the grace of God. Yet the boast is only labour and sorrow. You know, they're the two big things I see promoted in the news in our world. Labour, look at what we have achieved, what we have done. And sorrow, what are the tragedies in our world? That's the fruit of life that is temporal. But soon it is cut off. And look at that hint of eternity there. And that's accurate in the Hebrew as well. And we fly away. What's the question that comes? Where to? Where do we fly? Well, have you considered eternity? That determines where you fly. But if you don't consider it, it's already determined for you. I read an interesting, kind of funny story last night that I read to my daughter. It's about a girl who was in school, And she said she about the whale and Jonah, and the teacher said there is no whale. Whales have constricted throats. They cannot swallow a human being. It's impossible. It didn't happen. And they had this, and then the girl said, well, I'm going to ask Jonah when I get to heaven. And the teacher said, well, what if Jonah is not in heaven? What if he's in hell? The little girl said, well, then you can ask him. I don't think she got an A for that subject. But there's a hint there. That's the point. If we don't consider eternity, it's decided for us because we are headed to destruction. We don't choose destruction. We're on that path. Look at your life. It's dying. It's perishing. Think eternal and say, well, do I want to find another way? Is there another way? And therefore, a common word in here is return. Now we're about to start the prayer of Moses. This is all introduction. This is context for the prayer. But the prayer is very simple. But before we go into the prayer, I just want to look at the context, because the question comes, when did he write this? Because you think of Moses' life, it went everywhere from Genesis, you know, where they were captive in Egypt, right through to the Promised Land. And it kind of does make a difference where he prayed it, doesn't it? For example, a number of commentators, even Christian commentators, I'm shocked to say, will say, well, Moses couldn't have written this. Because it says that he says days of 70 to 80 years, correct, in verse 10. Well, how long did Moses live? He lived 120 years, according to Deuteronomy 33. Well, it can't be Moses. Moses doesn't believe it. He lived longer than that. So they say, well, yeah, hang on a minute. It says a prayer of who? End of discussion. It's a bit like Jonah and the whale. Well, you can argue throat sizes if you want, but if it says it's a prayer of Moses written by God, guess who wrote it? Here's where I think it was written, and I was influenced by a Dallas graduate in a Dallas Theological Seminary called Bob Diffenbaugh. I really like his writings, and he challenges me a lot. You can find him on Bible.org and have a look at his teachings there. But he suggests, and I totally agree with him, this was written before the Exodus. This was written before the law was given. This makes sense of it because you've got all these references to Genesis in there, the fall of man, the creation of man, the lifespan of man, the flood. It even refers to that in verse 4 and 5 where it says we are swept away like a flood all our years. But where's the references to the Exodus? Why would Moses, when in talking about the